33. Some afternoon winds up to 20 miles per hour. Right now, it's a little breezy. Wind west at 15, 22 degrees Kenosha, 20 in Racine, wind chill 9 above. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Was the delightful, charming music making of none other than Craig Gall, the conductor of the Kenosha Pops Concert Band, and a beloved figure in the history of the group, Frank Germanaro. Frank Germanaro passed away several days ago, and today's morning show is a tribute to Frank Germanaro, a shining light in our community in so many different ways. An educator, former teacher, former school principal, and as for the Kenosha Pops Band, he joined them as a member of the clarinet section way back in 1968, had a long stint as assistant conductor for much of the 1970s and 80s, ultimately music director and conductor, 1993 to 2002, handed over the baton to Craig Gall, and then came back as assistant conductor for several seasons. And what you just heard was a bit of a program which Frank and Craig played during the summer of 2020 when the COVID-19 pandemic necessitated the cancellation, essentially, of the Kenosha Pops season in Pennoyer Park. And they did two of these programs, and it reminded many of us of those charming moments which would often come on the final concerts of the summer season when Craig and Frank would take the stage and do some kind of duet, in many cases something which they had written together to bid farewell to the audience and welcome them back for the next season. I'm really happy to have Craig Gall with me on the phone to talk about his longtime friend and mentor, Frank Germanaro. Craig Gall, thanks for joining me on the morning show today.
Thanks for having me.
So this is something that, of course, a lot of us knew was coming, knowing that Frank was seriously ill. But nevertheless, it kind of comes as a stunning surprise all the same, doesn't it?
Well, for those of us who were close to him, we knew this time was very, very close. But for the general public, I'm sure it's come as quite a shock. He's been battling this ordeal here for several months now. And we hated to see our buddy in this situation. And quite frankly, it's a blessing, and he's in a much, much better place now.
So say a word about the kind of relationship which the two of you had over the course of these many years. It's a relationship that dated back even before you stepped on the podium as music director of the band. But sum up just how close the two of you were.
We were very, very close. I'm one of the best friends I've had over all these years, and what a great opportunity he gave me so many, many years ago when he tapped me to be his assistant conductor. I was actually on my way out of town when he asked me to be the director of the band. I had accepted the high school directing job in Kimberly, Wisconsin, and I said, Frank, I'd love to do this, but I'm leaving. He said, well, you can stay with my wife and me at the house in the summers. We've got a room in the basement for you. And that's how this all started. And over the years, we just became fast friends. And it just was a wild and exciting and fun ride the entire time.
One thing I want to be sure to have you speak to is Frank's talents as a musician, because I think one drawback to him having such a sunny, fun-loving personality and also a very self-deprecating sense of humor is that I fear that people didn't always understand just what a crackerjack musician he in fact was and how seriously he took music making for all of the fun he had doing it.
Well, and that's one of the neat things that I think struck a chord for the two of us, is that when we were in front of that band, we had two goals in mind. Number one was to put a quality product out for the people of Kenosha. And number two, our job is to entertain the people. And Frank knew that from the get-go. He knew that from all of the years he was involved in the Kenosha Pops. When he was on the podium, he just generated joy and excitement and enthusiasm out of the musicians in the band. And I think that transferred over very easily to those who are listening in the audience every Wednesday night in Pennoyer Park. He was a fantastic accordion player. He could fake his way out of anything. And between the two of us faking our way out of everything simultaneously, we came up with some pretty entertaining time on the band shell for the people. It was just so much fun collaborating with him, not only, you know, from a musical standpoint when we were playing together our little duets or singing together, but just formulating the summer programs and picking themes. And we would bounce ideas off of each other, and we thought they were going to work. It was great. And if one of us thought we better move on, there were no questions asked. It just was this symbiotic relationship that we had that made things so fun.
And, of course, he set a very high standard when it comes to having fun and of making really good music and sharing it with the public so joyously. So I have a sense already that that spirit and that example lives on vibrantly from here on out. Craig Gall, music director, conductor of the Kenosha Pops Concert Band, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show.
It's been a pleasure talking about my good buddy.
Let me call you sweetheart, I'm in love with you. Let me hear you whisper that you love me too. Keep the love like glory in your eyes so true. Let me call you sweetheart, I'm in love with you.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's program is a memorial tribute to Frank Geminaro, who passed away this past Thursday at the age of 74. We're going to finish out the program by listening back to a most memorable conversation, which I recorded back in the spring of 2010 with Frank and with his wife, Janet Geminaro. Janet had just thrown for Frank a huge, wonderful surprise party celebrating the 40th anniversary of Frank receiving a transplanted kidney. This was at a point in time when it was exceedingly uncommon for a kidney transplant recipient to reach such a milestone. It was certainly something worth celebrating in a very big way.
Well, his anniversary date is March 11, 2070, and so the party was on March 14th. And I kind of made up a story about a cousin of his who was going to have this big surprise party for his wife. I called him and Johnny, and I said, isn't your wife like, don't you have like an anniversary this year or some big birthday? And he said, well, she's going to be 55 this year. I said, perfect, double nickel birthday. That's what we're having.
Okay.
So my sister-in-law, Carmela, actually mailed me an invitation to this supposed party. And we were
I didn't want to go.
Yeah. And I said, and at the same time, a good girlfriend of mine, her daughter is having a bridal shower, Ashley, that same day. So when she got my invitation, she called and said, oh, my God. I can't have my shower the same day. I want to be at your party. You have to be at mine. So she changed her date at the Italian American, but again, sent me a bogus invitation for that day. And I told Frank, you know, she has 150 women coming to this Italian shower. I said, everybody in town's coming. It's upstairs in the ballroom. So that's how we kind of played that. So when I was making all the Italian cookies and I made 40 sugar cookies, I used another excuse for that. He figured it was all for these other things we were going to.
I was clueless.
The funny thing is, you see, you know, his cousin, he said, I just am really surprised my cousin John's having this party. And I said, well, what a nice guy. He said he had one when she was 40, and he thought 55, something different. Nobody'd ever believe that. And so that's how we kind of pulled
it
off.
I bought it.
Bought it pretty much, yeah.
You know, that's almost scary, the skill with which you pulled it. I'm glad you're working for a good cause in this case.
I'll tell you, our parish priest, Father Stephen Forrest, blessed me a number of times. I said, Father Stephen, I'm like lying through my teeth every moment of every day. And he kept blessing me. It's okay, you know. So he was the one that said to me, though, I don't know if I can do this. He goes, I see Frank all the time. I can't do this. I said, Father, if you blow the surprise, I said, you are going to be in such trouble. He said, I just won't talk to him. I won't talk to him. I said, okay, that's a good plan.
There
so
you go.
It was, a lot of, you know, covering my lies with other lies and, you know, trying to keep it
You're
quiet.
You're pretty skilled at that. I'm going to have to remember this.
I am unfortunately pretty good at covering up things.
So you walk into, would it be the upper floor of the Italian American Club, thinking it's going to be this shower for somebody else, and instead
it
it's,
was for me.
So when you walked through the door, what happened? Was it just a bunch of screaming
people? Well,
there
was a cameraman was right in my face.
Channel 12 was there.
And everybody jumped up and said, surprise, and I thought, I'm going to kill her.
But he said he suspected something in the parking lot because there were some very nice cars there. We had a number of his doctors from Milwaukee, so he thought, these aren't my cousin's cars. Something's up here.
We're in pickup trucks. They're not in pickup
trucks. Interesting. And so what ensued at that party?
Well, we had a wonderful dinner, and we had a program. I had a number of speakers that I had asked to say something, and one of his good friends, Dr. Alan Rosa, who's a transplant surgeon at Frederick, is a good buddy of his, and one of his friends from the Kidney Foundation in Milwaukee, and then, of course, Suzanne Wyckoff, who's the
Associate Director
of the National Kidney Foundation, came from New York, which was wonderful.
Wow.
And she had a big proclamation for him, which was hysterical in the fact that it was all, you know, who
tongue
for what, all tongue-in-cheek. It was,
in
she
old
read
English.
The whole thing. It was just hysterical, which, of course, we have at home. And, it's so we just had a really nice program and dinner. And the funny thing is his brother, Gerdo, was in charge of him that morning. They were going to go golf in the indoor golf place in Milwaukee. Well, he didn't, of course, call, and they were closed. So, so then it's like, what do we do now? So, and he let Frank drive, which is anybody that knows my husband drives, you know, the speed limit or a little under. And
I'm in no hurry.
Gerdo was like, you know, knowing he had to get there at 2, I had everybody there at 1:30, and 2 o'clock comes and goes. No, Gerdo, 2:10, 2:15, I'm calling him saying, Gerdo, where are you? He said, well, first of all, let Frank drive. That was a first mistake. And we're still, you know, not quite there. So they were a little bit late, so I had to kind of, I got everybody sitting down and kind of told them the story of how the party came off and, you know, did a little stuff, ensued, you know, did a little humor and stuff. And so finally he showed up. And
so you were already there.
Yes, we
and
were already
so,
there.
And so Frank's brother was bringing him. And so you knew where he was and you knew why they were late.
Right. And Frank's brother was the MC. I picked him. His older brother, Leo, was supposed to be there and couldn't get a flight from Arizona. So I had asked Gerdo to MC it, and which was great because Gerdo was 7 years younger than Frank, actually born on the same day.
Huh.
And he lived through a lot of what Frank went through and missing him when he was at the hospital for days and weeks at a time. And so he had some a different side of Frank. That
different perspective.
Perspective. And yeah. He was so funny. I mean, everybody just howled the entire
imagine
afternoon.
Frank Germanaro's brother being funny.
That, yeah, can you imagine that? Yeah.
Stunning
yeah.
The
surprise.
The whole family's like
great.
That. I'm sorry to say.
A friend of wow. mine has a daughter who made a kidney cake, which Dr. Ranieri, Frank's doctor here in town,
we
said
had a kidney cake.
It looked just like a kidney. I mean, it had the veins and the arteries, and the colors were perfect, and it was pretty funny looking, but and people were afraid to eat it. We cut it real quick. And, of course, she made it out of red velvet, so, of course, when you cut it, it was red. And,
oh, dear.
But the doctors were just amazed at the cake and that, yeah it just was a perfect
we just
day.
Had a nice time.
It was
wow.
a perfect, perfect day. Yeah.
And, again, when you're talking about the doctors, mm-hmm. you're meaning at least some of the doctors who were part yes. of this transplant 40
yes.
years earlier.
Right.
Well, four of them are dead.
Yeah,
well, it's really something, you know.
Yeah.
When you think, like I said, you don't realize 40 years is passing, and there's
yeah.
particular markers that,
sure.
and that's part of it.
Yeah,
great people, and yeah. but you know, we all meet our time, don't
sure.
we?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but I mean, it was neat that there were even mm-hmm. some of them that
yeah,
were
yeah,
around.
Yeah, two of his nephrologists who are still with him now.
Wow.
In fact, the one nephrologist there had told us when before we got married that we wouldn't probably have children, and Frank would maybe live 5 years. And so he was there at the party, and of course, after we kept having child after child after child, I thought, oh, Dr. Peering, you know, what are you doing to me here? You told me no kids. And that's a big joke in our family. I figured 5 years, no kids, Frank would be gone. I'd only be 25. I could go on, you know, get married again, you know. And 40 years later, here he still is
are.
With four children and a grandson. Yeah.
Oh,
so
my gosh.
It's been great.
Yeah. Not all predictions work
no,
out in
no.
this case.
No, absolutely not.
Thank
nope.
goodness.
Nope.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Frank and Janet Germanaro. And as we've just been relating. Earlier this year, in the spring, Frank celebrated the 40th anniversary of his kidney transplant, and it is not at all common for someone to reach that milestone. So it was an occasion worth celebrating, and as Janet's just been relating, she conceived and coordinated and created a magnificent celebration of this milestone, which garnered a lot of attention in the media, and we're spending some time talking about it now today. So, Frank, tell us a little bit about, first of all, the situation that necessitated your kidney transplant 40 years ago. First of all, when did problems first start to make themselves
evident?
Oh, really?
At birth, yeah. Yeah. My kidney problem started with the smallest of a little abnormality that I had. I had a narrowing of the tube where you urinate. It's called a stricture, but they didn't know that I had one. And so over time, urine would back up and it would infect the kidneys. And in those days, they didn't have the drugs. In 1948, 49, they didn't have the drugs that they have now to be able to treat something like that. And
so
just one thing led to another.
So you weren't born with kidney trouble.
No.
You were born with this sort of obstruction. Plumbing
yeah.
trouble.
Yeah, probably.
And that eventually led to something, in a sense, I suppose, sort of
right.
poisoning your kidneys.
Yeah, it led to glomerular nephritis, which is the glomeruli are the little filters that are in your kidney. It's what makes the kidney work.
Mm-hmm.
And they just slowly and deteriorated until both kidneys just stopped working when
wow.
I was 19.
Wow.
So it's remarkable that they kept me going until I was 19. That
well,
was,
right,
yeah,
or we
yeah.
wouldn't be sitting here
right.
having this conversation,
right.
would we?
I was very, very fortunate that
wow.
I was able to make it that long. Yeah.
What is it like to live with that kind of escalating kidney trouble, especially back then? I mean, what kinds of things would start to go wrong, or in what ways did this problem sort of gradually encroach on you?
Well, it's just, first of all, the chronic infections. You're always dealing with a chronic infection. I had to have different types of drainage tubes put in me to bypass the narrowing. Loss of weight, energy. You know, your energy wasn't too good. Your kidneys are also master chemists in your body, too. Your liver is the number one master chemist, but the kidneys are involved in producing red blood cells and other enzymes and all that other stuff.
So when it gets when you have trouble with that, it affects your well-being.
Well-being, the whole thing. And the remarkable thing about it is that you could live a pretty normal life with 25% function on one kidney.
Wow.
You know. That's why they're so important. Hmm. Yeah.
What is your recollection of your parents and your siblings, for that matter,
in terms of handling this situation with you?
I cannot say enough about my parents when you think about, because I was in the hospital probably two or three times a year. Dr. Richard, his father, and then Dr. John Richard took care of me all the time, kept me going. I was in the hospital a lot. My parents had to do little medical procedures on me every day to keep things flowing. They were just wonderful. You can't say enough about them. So I guess it's what parenting's all about, right, honey?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
And were your siblings just tremendously sweet towards you because of all this?
No, they weren't. They were just normal siblings. I can remember I developed renal rickets, which is just a form of getting knock knees into rickets.
Renal rickets.
Renal rickets.
Sounds like a name of a professional wrestler or something.
Actually, it's a rock band in the 90s.
Okay, all right.
Renal rickets and the knock knees.
Okay,
and that's what I developed. But my sister used to pull me around the house, say, come on, you got to get up and walk. Well, that was the worst thing that could happen. We had a lot of fun.
Right.
I don't ever remember being treated differently. Mm-hmm. We used to have a lot of fun. We used to argue,
sure,
play, you know.
Well, that was probably good. I mean, if they'd sort of tiptoed around you like you were a step away from death, that would not have probably been good either.
No, I could tell they were worried at times, but most of the time they treated me like any of the other kids. You know?
Did you miss a lot of school because of this situation?
Well, you know, I went to orthopedic. It was the old orthopedic school, you know, where Jane Vernon is.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's the orthopedic school. But it used to be in Jefferson's Annex. Jefferson School, in back of it, had a little school, and it was called the Jefferson Annex. That was the old orthopedic open-air school. I think they built it when the big TB outbreaks were happening in the country in the 1920s. But then they used it for children who had handicaps, you know. And I went to the school because I just couldn't be bumped, or I couldn't run like the other kids and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I went to, until eighth grade. And then ninth grade, I went to Washington Junior High School.
Whoa.
Oh, that was a rude awakening. I wasn't ready for that. And then I went to regular school after that. But that's where I went to school. So I guess it was sheltered in that way. I was sheltered somewhat in that way, but I never felt that way. I never felt sheltered. No.
Or unduly sheltered.
Unduly sheltered.
Probably just sheltered enough.
I mean, it was more like I'm always arguing, I want to ride a bike. No, you can't. No, well, then I did anyways. You know, screw myself
a tree
up.
Yeah.
Can't climb trees. I was up trees. You know, stuff like that. Shouldn't take a shower. Well, I took showers. You know?
Ever the
rebel.
When
there was particular open wounds and stuff, you really shouldn't do that stuff.
Right.
Yeah, well.
Now, you obviously are a musician, or pretend to be.
Yes, I do. Doing pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Made a pretty good living.
No, absolutely. No, you are a musician, absolutely.
You.
No question about it. I don't remember what kind of music making you did as a young person.
As 12 years old, my mother wanted me to play accordion. I wanted to play string bass, but she wanted me to play accordion. So I took accordion lessons, and then by about 16 years old, I already had my first little bands going around, and we played a lot of weddings, hundreds of weddings and parties. And then when I went to college, I never had a thought of going into music. That it was going to be something maybe in the sciences. I really enjoyed the sciences. And
you'd seen the sciences up close more than a lot of people your age.
And so I went to the extension, as it was called then, and that's when I got real sick in 1968. I started, which is now Parkside, in 1966, but in 68 I was very, very sick, and I had to go on a kidney machine in 1968.
You mean dialysis?
Dialysis, yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. I still use an old
terms. Yeah.
Dialysis in 1968.
Wow.
Through 1970, then when I received the transplant. So
at some point in this moment, or this in this chapter of your life, this is when the problem started to become so serious then?
Right. I really couldn't function. So it's not that music was easy, because it never was easy for me, because I didn't have music in high school. I didn't do any of the marching bands and stuff like that.
Right.
But I sort of fell into it naturally, got into a group of guys, and before you know it, I was a music major.
Wow.
It was wonderful. It's been a wonderful vocation and advocation.
Of course. And it probably made a nice difference for the better in your life as you were contending with all of this.
Well, that's where I met my wife, was at a music store. We were teaching together.
She
taught piano and organ, and I taught accordion. And
yep.
One thing led to another, and before you know it, I'm married.
The rest
is history.
Oh, yeah. A happy history.
Yeah.
So let's get back now to this urgent situation that necessitates the kidney transplant.
Right.
By the way, what's it feel like to think back to these events? I mean, before the transplant, I mean, which are, I'm sure, not some of the happier memories of your life. Is it weird or
it's
hard?
It's weird. It's hard. You know, don't forget, it's pretty bittersweet because, okay, I went on the kidney machine, but before I could go on the kidney machine, my case had to be presented before a death and dying committee.
Wow.
In university hospitals, because there weren't that many dialysis machines for people. They had a finite amount. There was just a few.
Wow.
And you know, so
do you have
I
any...
passed that. I remember, you know, they said I was – there was three or four of us guys in one room at university hospitals, and I can still remember this. They said to these other people that were in the room, we're going to give you some medication. You can go home. Don't worry. You'll be well. I said, you have to stay. We're going to – put you on this machine.
So would it be that because your situation was especially serious?
No, it's because probably I didn't have any what they call comorbidity. Morbidity or other sicknesses to go with it. It was just kidneys. My heart was strong. My liver was strong.
I see.
You know, everything was strong. So I was a good candidate for what they called chronic dialysis.
And you were young, too.
And I was young. I was 19.
So you were younger than would
than
be
the other people. Yeah.
Okay, younger than the norm. And it was more likely that you would survive.
Right. That's exactly what it was. And make a good use of a resource. Wow. I know that's hard for people to understand, but that's how it is.
That was the reality then.
Right. And so so then they put me on the machine.
I see what you mean, though, that how bittersweet that is. That
it's bittersweet.
These young other men in your room maybe or maybe didn't understand the...
Right. Well, they didn't know. They were happy to go home.
Right.
Yeah.
And in a sense,
that
decision was saying you're not likely to survive.
Right. But see, now I didn't realize that at the time. You realize this stuff later on, the same with the transplant. I mean, my family was ecstatic. But on the other side of it, there is a 13-year-old girl who just died of a brain tumor.
Mm.
Well, my God. You know,
you
have to balance the joy. I guess, and you know, everything is mathematical. It's equal.
Yeah, yin and yang.
Yin and yang.
You
know.
Yeah, someone else's tragedy was your family's joy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. So you go on dialysis.
Right.
And was that much like it is now?
No, it was much different. It was three times a week, 6 to 8 hours.
Mm.
The machine or the dialysis machine wasn't – actually not the machine itself, but the coil that they put the blood through wasn't as efficient as the coils are now.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Now I guess they go 3 to 4 hours twice a week.
And what does it feel like when you're on dialysis?
There's no pain. There's no pain. You're probably – in my case, I would drink and eat too much. Being young, I shouldn't have had that pizza or that beer. You shouldn't do that. But so I probably had a water overload and my poisons were sort of built up in my blood. But because I was young, and you know, it washed out pretty fast. That was okay.
So more than anything, it's just this frustrating immobility.
Well, of course, and you know, from 68 to 70, that's sort of limbo for Parkside because I was only to take one or two classes, able to take one. So that's actually when the change went from science to music, which I loved anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So at what point then did it – I mean, as soon as you went on dialysis, was the hope that you would be able to get a transplant?
No, not right away. Because of the same problem that caused my kidneys to fail, I still have. I even have it now. But the treatments for it are a lot better. You see, the treatments have improved. So,
you talk about your mom getting involved in all of it, too.
Oh, yeah, my mother, and all of Kenosha getting together and having a unit at St. Catherine's Hospital. I mean, that was a whole...
For what?
For a kidney machine,
yeah. They had a fundraiser in Kenosha.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
so there would be one there for you.
So actually what happened was is that in time, this is how Kenosha got their dialysis center. Was through, they called it Frank's Kidney Fund, to raise money so that I didn't have to go back and forth to Milwaukee the community here, Local 72, St. Catherine's Hospital, the Good Sisters.
Earl Beckman
was just my neighbor who was somebody who started the whole thing with my father.
Because otherwise that you couldn't have done that here in Kenosha at all.
Right. Well, and in those days, 1969, there were different rules that medical societies had for handling blood
because originally, didn't the medical society say no?
Yes.
I read some articles that said they would not allow to have a machine here.
Yeah.
And that's when Earl Beckman and the community came together and said, we have to do this. We have to have a unit for Frank.
And my mom and dad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they had spaghetti dinners. I still have a ticket from Frankie's Kidney Fund dinner at Mount Carmel, I think it was.
Yeah,
and
all the churches.
They all came together and raised the money. I know there were a bunch of thank yous in the Voice of the People and pleas out there, dances and
a lot of the
parties.
Businesses.
Not
only the Italian businessmen, because I'm very Italian,
but
there were
really?
A lot like
really?
Everybody pulled together. And that's how the dialysis unit started at St. Catherine's.
Wow.
And wouldn't you know it, I was on the machine maybe 3 months at St. Catherine's, and I had to have a different procedure on my arm to get at my blood, and they weren't doing that yet at St. Catherine's, so I had to go back to Milwaukee to run anyways. But then about 6 months later, I had the transplant, so it.
There you go.
But at least Kenosha now has their dialysis.
But then your mother learned how to run him on dialysis. And she had an eighth grade education.
Yeah.
She
became a technician.
She became a technician and actually had nurses in the dialysis units at St. Cat's, but they always called her the boss. Because she kind of...
Kidding around. Yeah.
Yep. If you needed something, you asked Elsie because Elsie really knew. So after he got his transplant, she continued on as a technician at St. Catherine's for many years.
Wow.
In the dialysis
Even after your dialysis days were over.
Yeah. And here she was only an eighth grade education and she was afraid she couldn't do it. And she
like
did it for
you,
her
my
son.
My parents were great.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah,
wow.
It's
you know.
Amazing people.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's probably hard for you to imagine what this experience would have been without them. I mean, with other parents.
Or parents that, I don't know.
Yeah,
but
sure.
My parents had a wonderful extended family. Mm-hmm. I mean.
Oh, the aunts and uncles and
everybody.
Wow.
You have to have that support.
Yeah, pretty cool.
So you, at some point, it became apparent that you would need a transplant.
Well, that was sort of my choice. And I went and I hunted around. And I shopped.
He hates to shop now, though.
I hate to shop now.
Yeah, but then you shop, yeah.
Actually, I was asking around. I've by now, I'm pretty involved in the Kidney Foundation, and I'm at workshops, and I'm working.
You mean 40
them.
Years ago, you're
yes.
saying? Okay, 40 years ago.
1968, I started selling Halloween candy out of a guy, Harry Pulaski was his name, up in Milwaukee. Because they were trying to make a foundation for kidney disease.
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh. So you were already embracing this as a cause.
Right. And I started to go to workshops and lectures. And I heard this Dr. Kaufman talking. And after I listened to him, I went up to him. I said, you know, they told me I can't really have him because of this, and this. He was sort of he was like a master sergeant.
Crotchety.
He said, don't worry. We can fix you up. You come and see me.
Wow.
So I went to see him, and he put me on the list.
Mm-hmm.
So you were the one who was thinking, boy, this would release me from the bondage of dialysis.
Right, absolutely.
If such a thing were possible.
Yeah.
Wow. So, and at this time, so this is 1969 or 1970.
Yeah.
Is this still a relatively uncommon procedure?
In 1970, I think they did 27 transplants in Wisconsin, and I was one of them.
Wow.
Yeah. In fact, that was when I went and got transplanted, there were three patients that had a transplant. I had a buddy who she received the other kidney from this young woman, and I received one.
Hmm. So you got one kidney.
One kidney, and it's not in my gut. It's sort of sits in my pelvic region. You know how your pelvic bone has a little hollows in it?
Yeah.
Well, they set it right down in there.
Oh, how cozy.
So it's in front instead of back.
So it's in front instead of back. And,
Wow.
Yeah, they rearranged the plumbing.
Wow. Very interesting.
Yeah, it is.
I got to interview Alonzo Mourning, the NBA basketball star who had a kidney transplant.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember in that one of the interesting things in his book is where he talks about how in a typical transplant, they're worried about your size. I mean, I hear this guy's like 6'8".
Oh, absolutely. Wow.
And so the size of his kidney and where it would go and so on, they really needed to try to find a donor who would be comparable size.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Wow. Was that an issue? Obviously, you're not 6'8".
Well, I was a 13-year-old girl, and I was 21 at the time. So it fit.
I know that, well, you know something about this girl, but my understanding is that you never knew her name.
No, back in those days that we weren't introduced to our donor families. Mm-hmm. It wasn't on then.
Right.
Yeah, but I have tried through the National Kidney Foundation, and to try to find his donor family. Yeah. And, you know, again, she was 14.
14. See, she knows more than I do.
And, you know, my sister-in-law talked about the day that Frank got the call and that they had to get him up to, you know, Milwaukee County real fast. And her boyfriend at the time drove him and they got stopped by the police and they for speeding.
Oh, yeah. State troopers stopped
State troopers stopped you.
Oh, because to get you there in timely fashion.
In those days, they didn't have. Now they could take a kidney out and they have a little machine they could put the kidney on. And it stays viable for like up to 3 days. In those days, you had like 4 or 5 hours once they take it out.
So he got stopped by the police for speeding, and then the police weren't buying the story of him having a transplant.
I don't know why. See three teenage people in a car in an EMX saying, yeah, I got to get to the hospital. I need a transplant. Sure, buddy.
Sure you
see
do.
Your registration. Sure, buddy. And poor police officer.
And did they find didn't he follow you to Frater?
He followed us to Frater.
Milwaukee County,
Milwaukee County
at the time,
And then he waved to us as they came out with the meat wagon and put me on the meat wagon.
Oh, my word.
And wheeled me in.
So this police officer eventually believed you.
Well, he believed it then.
Eventually,
I mean,
so
let's
face
it. So we
knew, you know, the time she probably, my sister-in-law said she, you know, died the day that he had his transplant. And so I had first check with Frank's friend, Dr. Alan Rose, up at Frater and said, Alan, you know, how can I go about trying to find this donor family? It's not that I want to have him at the party or even meet them, but I want them to know or someone from her family to know what his life has been because of her, their gift.
Of
you know?
Course. Yeah.
So he hooked me up with the Wisconsin Donor Network who was searching. And Frank, you don't know any of this because I was doing it online. and they checked and then they finally emailed me back and said 40 years ago they didn't keep records. So they really had no way to find that out. So then I went appealed to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And then Channel 12, that's how Channel 12 got involved. I got hooked up with a lady named Susie from WISN and got her email and put it out there. And they emailed me back and said, it's a wonderful story. We'd like to do something with it. And then they, in turn, putting it on TV, hoped that someone from her family, I said, she was 14. It was 40 years ago. Maybe her parents aren't even alive. Maybe they aren't in the area. But maybe there's a cousin or an uncle or someone that says, you know, I remember that. That used to be our neighbor. Some way to be able to reconnect with a family just to let them know of what their gift has done for his life. So the Journal Sentinel had finally emailed me back, actually a couple weeks after the party, and said that they thought they had a couple of leads. But then that's where it ended. And I guess in my head, I think I would really like to know, but at the same time, I guess maybe it's just not meant to be, you know. But 40 years ago, they didn't do that. But you always, you know, wonder. And Frank never wanted to open any old wounds. He didn't want to bring to the surface something.
It's a sad time.
Yeah, it's a terrible time for the people.
Right.
But yet, wouldn't it be wonderful that for them to know that, look at what he's become because of their unselfish gift at the time. So, you know, who knows? Maybe someday it will pop up and all of a sudden they'll be able to tell us something. But, so I was trying to investigate that, too. And that's how Channel 12 got involved. And then Channel 12 was going to come to a school to do an interview with him, and then Channel 6 found out about it because it went out on the AP, I guess, that National put out there, and so Channel 6 is calling him, and Channel 12's like, well, they're not going to scoop us. We were the guys that were scooped, so they came the day before, and it was just like a media frenzy of cameras everywhere, and the kids at school were all excited, and you know, and then Channel 12 said, we want to be at the party, you know, so they came to the party and taped there, too, so it was really, really nice.
Wow. Now you know what the parents of an American Idol winner go through.
I don't know. You know, it really gets to you after a while. You know, you turn around and there's a mic in your mouth or something like that. It does get to you. I found out that the AP, a lot of newspapers picked it up. Someone from Australia told me that it was out there. And it was in London.
Yeah.
I know that. So they picked up, just a little byline.
A little blurb,
So it's sort of something.
Wow. Well, and of course, now the story's out there.
Right.
And maybe somebody who's connected with this family we'll still,
you still don't
stumble
know.
Across it.
It would be nice.
It would be nice.
At least just to say thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
absolutely.
And Frank wrote a couple articles for the National Kidney Foundation's newsletters and the one in Milwaukee, and he had his email address in there, and he has gotten some emails from people who are going through the same thing or have known him years ago or encouraged by his words in these articles that he wrote. And, so it's been really kind of neat because all of a sudden he'll get an email from somebody saying, I read your article. It was great. And now he's going to be participating in some way in the transplant games, which are in Madison, the end of July, beginning of August this year. So he's going to be speaking on their closing ceremonies for donor families. And
So you're not throwing the shot put or anything.
No, well,
in fact, they want me to do something. I said, do you have TV remote clicking? Yeah. I'm very good at
that's
that.
What I told him. If you've got a big screen TV, a recliner, and a remote control, he is your man.
How about, accordion sprint or something like that. I don't know.
Well, that's exercise.
It's on bowling or golfing.
No, I think it's wonderful to see all those people who've received transplants, heart, lung, liver. They're so active and viable. Mm-hmm. People have to see that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, of course.
They really do.
Absolutely.
And that, it's just that with my renal rickets.
Yeah, right.
You don't have to.
I'm not too fast in agile.
No. You do other things well.
Yes.
Yeah. So one of the reasons you have had this longevity with your transplant is because you were so young when you had your transplant.
Yes. So, young and the match, even though it was a B match, in those days they used to match up antigens. They don't do that much now. It's something different. I should keep up with this, but I don't. Anyways, like right now I could probably get a kidney from my wife, which would be unheard of when I had it.
So back then it had to be a fairly closer match right from the start. Mm-hmm. Wow.
And then the all the medicine that I still take, you know, to keep rejection at bay. I still have to take all that. So it's never yours.
Yeah.
Yeah. Take care of your kidneys. There's nothing better than your own. I'll
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, over these years, in terms of your kidney function, has this kidney served you well, or have there been some scares?
It has served me wonderfully. Yes, it's served me well. Mm-hmm. It's gone through a lot. Of course, it ages like everything else, so my filtration rate isn't a boomer anymore like I was a young kid, but more than enough to keep me going. Yeah, and that's what you want.
Absolutely.
But unfortunately, you have other things because of it, like high blood pressure and different other things
all
that come up.
Problems.
Yeah, he's joint problems from his years of steroid use. I mean, he's been on steroids for 40 years, and that's
I have a lot of stuff like that. Yeah, but that's nothing to me. What are you gonna do?
So tell us what this lady sitting next to you has contended with over the years, besides just you.
Well, we have four children, and God being the ever joker, we have two hearing impaired and one deaf child, and one child that hears well, but he doesn't listen. My favorite line. So we have four beautiful kids. So I guess, we had our challenges also as parents. And, boy, that made me appreciate my parents more, knowing that our kids are beautiful. They're wonderful. We like them like they are. They're our kids. But we've had our challenges also. And 3 years ago, they discovered I had
two and a half years ago,
cancer. So I went through that, prostate cancer. Wouldn't you know it? I saw a urologist for 36 years every 6 weeks to keep things flowing. Never once did we ever suspect or ever think that anything like that was it. And the PSAs were checked and everything.
Wow.
And all of a sudden, one day it was stage three and it already spread.
Whoa.
But it was, it was kind of hard because he...
I couldn't believe it.
He was retiring.
He
this physician retired from Kenosha, went part-time at Fredert, Dr. John Schmidt. And he just told Frank, before I retire, let's just, his PSA jumped a little bit, but certainly not in the danger range. And said, let's just make sure. Let's just do a biopsy. So he did, and everything looks great. Everything looks fine. I think it's going to be great. And a week later, we went back for a biopsy report. He could hardly talk to us. He was so upset. He said, you have a stage three. It's, Gleason scale 9 out of 10. We just left in disbelief. It was like, you got to be kidding me.
I want to die of kidney disease.
Who wrote this script?
So he went right into 40 radiation treatments, which he got through very well. And the people at Fredert and the oncology department and his oncologists were wonderful. And then he, unbeknownst, he just decided to be part of a study that was chemotherapy treatments followed after the radiation. And the idea was, the study was doing chemotherapy, which would normally be the follow-up if you were to have a recurrence of a prostate cancer, to follow it with chemo right away. Would you have a better outcome than, you know? And so
if there's a delay.
Right. And so, of course, Frank said, oh, sure, I'll participate, you know. And after the pick me, please. And he had chemo every 3 weeks for 6 treatments. And after about the 3rd treatment, he was like, what did I think I was doing? You know, I could have been done with the radiation, you know. So, but actually, I mean, he really, other than chemo days, he did not miss any school. He was there in the morning and, you know, he was a little more tired.
Of course,
tired,
I fell asleep at the computer.
Yeah,
all
well, that's
the time,
okay. Right? Yeah. But they were amazed at Frater of how well he did and how much, you know, he continued with his life, even though he was going through all of these treatments. And, you know, of course, I always say that the only reason he's even here is because you married me 36 years ago. Otherwise, you would have been dead years ago, honey. I'm telling you. You would have been, you know. But
I'll let you take all the balls.
She's kept you plugged in, hasn't she?
Oh, boy, did she get me plugged in.
Well, I know she's got to get back to work and probably grab lunch. But one last question.
Sure.
Frank, most of these years until today, as we record this, you've been a teacher and or a principal.
Right.
Today, as we record this on Monday, the whatever it is, the 28th of June, this was your last day at St. Mark's, last stop in the many places you've been as a principal. What difference do you think this experience that you've had has made for you as an educator and working with children, working with teachers, or is it a little early to even be aware of those kind of things?
Well, you know, I love my career as an educator and as a principal. I liked helping teachers. I like to watch teachers help kids. And that's what it's all about. You know, that's our future generations. And we have a responsibility to make sure our children get the best education they can, whether it be private or public. I mean, I don't, you know, it's our responsibility. It's kept me young. When you work with children, you do keep young. Hmm. I couldn't play Foursquare anymore. Or when they say, come on, Mr. G, jump in and hopscotch or whatever. I said, no, thank you.
Double Dutch, yeah.
No more Double Dutch, you know, and stuff like that. Or I really enjoyed working with the bands. And that was a lot of fun, too. I don't know. I think it's been a blast. And who says that this is going to be my last retirement? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Oh. I might have something.
He saw her honey-do list
and I said, God.
Oh, boy.
Looks like I need a job again.
But I think his attitude, you know, anybody that knows Frank knows that he has got such an amazing attitude about life. And I think, I'm sure that because he was so near death, I mean, he had the last race 3 times when he was in all the midst of his medical problems. And I think he lived through that and developed this wonderful attitude that, you know, whatever is going to happen is going to happen. And I think that makes him who he is to be able to have the positive attitude on life because of that.
Just make the world a little better than what you found it.
That's and all. Laugh. And
it's really simple. And, you know, people are always looking for the deep meaning of life.
With big, long words.
Yeah, you don't. You just make things a little better than, you know.
Yep. Do the best you can in the life
that
you have.
Do the best you can.
You know,
serve
be grateful for it.
Yeah, what are you going to do?
Hmm. Yep.
But have fun while you're doing it.
Oh, of course.
Well, I get the impression you've managed to do
that. I managed to do that.
Yep, you've managed that real well.
Yeah. Frank Germanaro and Janet Germanaro, what a great story this is, and I do appreciate you taking time to tell it in such remarkable detail. It's been great to revisit this, and we wish you the very best and 40 more happy years with your with your kidney.
You bet.
Thanks
again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Greg.
Let despots remember. as they march to the fray, that by their might and by their right it waits forever.
You can hear the preceding interview with Frank and Janet Germanaro in its entirety via the podcast version of The Morning Show. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Bird. We're approaching 9 o'clock here on WGTD. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Dr. Corinne Ness and Dr. Jojen